I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. There are many different ways to feel guilty. There's survivor's guilt. There's existential guilt, manipulative guilt. There's reparative guilt, collective guilt, anticipatory guilt, to name just a few. In fact, guilt has helped us survive as a species, allowing us to build communities and forge social bonds. Our guest, psychiatrist Jennifer Reed, has observed a specific kind of guilt in her private practice working with women. It's a generalized guilt that says, whatever you're doing, whoever you are, it's not good enough. Reed says this harsh self-criticism comes from a feeling of hyper-responsibility and control, constant caretaking, the fear of disappointing others, and the perceived need to be perfect. It can be debilitating to never measure up, disconnecting you from your feelings of worth and an authentic relationship with other people. Jennifer Reed has a new book that looks at the roots of this kind of guilt and provides a roadmap out of the anxiety. It's titled Guilt Free, Reclaiming Your Life from Unreasonable Expectations. She's an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Jennifer Reed, nice to have you with us on The Connection.
Marty, thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Well, let's start with the good things about guilt. Why do we need guilt?
Well, as you just were describing in your introduction, that we as a species evolved to experience guilt. And it's important because it actually helps us to connect with others, because it demonstrates, I see that something happened to you. I may be the one who caused that problem. I care about you and I want to make it better. I move toward you and I try to repair. And I think in that way, it does help us build community and recover if we have some sort of conflict or we make a mistake. It's just that, unfortunately, that adaptive guilt is only one type of guilt and not what I'm hearing so much.
Well, indeed, and I do want to get to the kind of guilt that you've been hearing about, but that kind of guilt requires saying I'm sorry. And that can be also, even in the sort of normal circumstances, mm-hmm. a tough thing to do and say.
It can be. You know, it's interesting. We didn't really learn until we were age, maybe 3 or 4, that we are our own entity and other people exist.
Right.
So that's step one. And that something could have happened to them that could be our fault or that we could have contributed to that. And that's really, we have to learn that as we get older. And we do that by seeing the people around us who might say, oh, you better say sorry. It looks like someone is upset and you've caused that problem. But I do think it can be difficult for us not only to say I'm sorry, but even just to admit right. I've hurt someone, right. especially if it's someone we care about, because we want to see ourselves as people who don't hurt others.
Well, picking up on that 3-year-old child, then what is the connection between empathy and guilt?
That's really important. So empathy, or just the sense that the ability to feel a feeling that someone else is feeling, is also something we have to learn as children. We don't have empathy when we're a brand new infant crying. Right. We just need food. We need to have our diaper changed. So we really start to learn, oh, okay, that person is feeling it. And I have these sort of mirror neurons in my brain that helps me to feel that as well. You're feeling sad. Wow, I feel sad too. And if it's my fault, I feel guilty. And that doesn't feel good. So I want to do something to make it better. I want to help you feel better, and then I can also feel right. better.
Tell us about the kind of, I guess, excessive guilt or however maladaptive guilt that you have been hearing, especially from your women clients or patients in your office.
Absolutely. So this is a much broader guilt, a generalized guilt. You know, adaptive guilt is this is a specific situation and I know who the victim might be in that situation and I can make a repair. I can apologize or do things differently. This is this broad generalized guilt that doesn't necessarily have a particular victim or that we've done something in particular wrong. It's this sense of I'm not doing enough. This elusive enough, which just is ever increasing, I feel like, in our modern life.
Whatever it is, it's never enough.
Exactly, exactly. That I should comes up a lot. I should be doing more. And as you talked about in the intro, that I should be able to control other people's emotions, which we know is a, you know, if I could do that in my practice, brilliant. But unfortunately, I can't do that there or in my private life.
There's just one sentence in your book where you say about yourself that this is something that you have either experienced or are struggling with yourself. How so?
I mean, absolutely, in so many different realms. I mean, I have a lot of different roles, as many, many women do these days, as a wife and a mother and, you know, a physician, that I'm trying to show up in each of these roles and do the best that I can. but finding that it did feel like I was just never doing enough. I was always sort of, when I would give my attention to the patients I was seeing, I wouldn't be taking care of something that my children needed. They needed me to sign a permission slip or fill out a form or buy an ad in their theater program. And I wasn't taking care of everything because I can't do all of those roles right. simultaneously. But I think there is this expectation, and we can talk about where those come from, to do that, to do things perfectly, because that then prevents anything bad happening to us, but also importantly to people that we care about.
Well, let's talk about the kind of societal pressures that you write about in this book. We'll get to the familial pressures to be perfect, but what is society saying maybe largely to women?
This is important because I think we are socialized from a very young age, and that means that the people around us are sort of teaching us that this is what a good, you know, young girl, older girl, woman does in this particular situation. So this is not just us kind of coming up with this ourselves. This is us swimming in the water of this culture. And some of those expectations we face, as you mentioned earlier, constant caretaking.
Right.
That from a very young age, we might be expected to take care of our, you know, the siblings in our family or a friend, or that our role is really to try and make sure everyone around us has what they need. And that carries on and certainly is magnified with motherhood and being a grandmother as well. So I think that one, this hyper responsibility for others' feelings and experiences, this sense that we need to be perfect in all things, including self-control. And that's really a struggle because that's this belief that I need to control my moods, how I feel them and how I share them, the way that I'm eating, my body, what my body looks like, maybe how much am I drinking, having a glass of wine, which I think sometimes can be a way to try and push guilt off just for a moment, right? So we have this sense of I need to be perfect in all of these things. And why is that? It's because I think that's what it takes to be valuable. Mm-hmm. That's what it takes to be loved.
Well, and caretaking, I mean, I think things are different and it obviously varies from family to family, but I think that caretaking has been so much a part of a woman's role in the family. And there's certain benefits that you get from that and pleasures that you get from that as well. How does that become then a burden or create a kind of anxiety that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's important. You know, I think that we, when we're thinking about caretaking, yes, of course, there are things about it that we really value in ourselves. Our identity is that I'm a good friend, a good mother. The trouble is when the expectation is I must do these things in order to feel like I'm good enough in this role. And anything short of that, I'm being really critical of myself for falling short. I think it's when those expectations become really sky high and unreasonable that we start to say, oh, I have to do all of this in order to be a good partner, for example, as opposed to let me just pay attention to the things I am doing and that I do enjoy doing as a caretaker. And it may be I enjoy caring for my aging parents. But if the expectation is this is what I must do, then I think that's where we get into some trouble and real suffering.
We've been talking a little bit about sort of societal pressures. I'm wondering inside the family, then what are those messages? What are those pressures, especially on the females, the women in the family?
I write about something called reflective appraisals, which is this concept from interpersonal therapy, this sense that we feel about ourselves based on how things were reflected back to us when we were growing up. And this is so, so powerful. This is, oh, I was the one in the family who always made sure everyone remembered everyone's birthdays. This is my older sister, so shout out to Jody. She still does that. So that I'm that person, or that I'm maybe the black sheep of the family, or I'm the academic one, et cetera, et cetera. These labels that we are given, whether it's explicit or it's just what we've absorbed, we can really carry that with us into adulthood. And people still think, okay, this is who she is. This is how she's going to respond. And I think when we start to hopefully push back on that and set reasonable boundaries and limits, there can be a real pushback, because if you've talked to any family therapist, you know that family systems are going to push back against anyone trying to make a change or to change the dynamic in that family. No, you're supposed to take care of this. That's your job. And so that's where I think that family pressure, it can be very hard, both in your own sense of identity and in your interaction with others, to push back on those labels.
I'm curious about, though, the kind of family where the women or the family members sort of absorb these unreasonable expectations and make it part of their mission or their goal in life or even their identity. And those people that sort of, they hear it, but it doesn't it doesn't intrude on their self-worth. What's the difference between those kinds of families, you think?
Interesting. I mean, I think you'd find individual members within each family that would have those different responses. I think when you are socialized and you have this belief that not only am I a caretaker, but that really, I'm really proud to be that. And this is why my family wants to see me, spend time with me, why I'm loved and valuable. When we start to sort of, when that's really tested or we start to push back on that, then you can see how that would just make us feel like our entire identity is under threat. But there might be other individuals in the family that that wasn't their label. And in fact, they may find the opposite, that when they start to try and express sincerity or try to express care, they've always been sort of the joker, the funny one, you know, who was just off doing their own thing. And the joke was like, oh, they forgot my birthday again, but that's just him or that's just her. And so I think there are differences in personalities, but also that continued socialization as we go along.
You have a formula for the kind of guilt that you're talking about, and it's guilt equals expectation minus reality. Translate that for us.
Sure. So really was looking at how do we kind of define guilt in a really simple, clear way so that we can use that equation in all these different contexts. And the question is, where are these expectations coming from? So our expectations are what we think we should be doing or able to meet. And then you subtract out what I call your perceived reality. So how you interpret reality, which isn't necessarily accurate, right? We all see things through our lens, and we might be really downplaying the ways that we're already contributing. So it's the difference between those expectations and what we're perceiving in our reality is where guilt lives. And so you can see as expectations go sky high and as we totally, you know, dismiss or really, you know, underestimate our contributions, guilt is the result.
I mean, it is a misperception is what you're saying, is that we are misperceiving what we think reality is or even the expectations are.
Absolutely. There's so many women. I use the example that I think is helpful in my own mind for tearing the scale. So when you have baking, you're baking, you place the bowl on the scale and you want to measure your dry goods, you click the tear button and it magically goes to zero. The bowl no longer weighs anything. And I do think we as women in particular do this with our own contributions and positive actions. We dismiss them because we're focused on what didn't I get right? What day did I not go to the gym? What did I get wrong with my relationship today? What did I do wrong at work? And I think that can really be a negative thing for women.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest today on The Connection is psychiatrist Jennifer Reed, and she's got a brand new book. It's called Guilt Free, and it's subtitled Reclaiming Your Life from Unreasonable Expectations. And she's an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're going to dig even deeper after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Our guest is psychiatrist Jennifer Reed, and we're talking about how to manage excessive guilt. And again, she's the author of a new book called Guilt Free. I think I know the answer to this, but I just want to give men their due, and you do see men in your private practice as well. So do men feel some version of this guilt? I know you wrote this book specifically because you heard this theme of all your, or most of your female patients talking about this excessive expectations that they felt. Are men feeling some version of this?
That's a big question.
Yes.
I think it was surprising to me how different the experiences were. And what I was finding, and again, this is the generalization of what I've seen, that men may feel guilty about a particular issue, but are able to sort of let that go. And that's more specific. And it's more based on, here's something that I didn't do right. I want to make a difference. So of course, men feel guilty. In fact, I've been reading George Saunders' book, Vigil, where he talks about really a protagonist who doesn't feel any guilt at the end of his life. And he's exploring why that can be a really negative thing. I think I also hear from men, I see a lot of men who are physicians and caretakers in other areas, teachers, educators, and I think they have a bit more of this kind of excessive guilt because they have been socialized that the work I do is to help people. So I need to be making sure I'm doing everything I can to the point of burnout and exhaustion. So certainly they do. But I'm finding that women with these so many expectations about a natural instinct for caretaking that people assume, which I think is not necessarily accurate, are facing more of this emotion.
I'm curious about, and you touched on this, but I want to dig a little deeper into the role of perfectionism. Mm. I mean, I think of it as a kind of toxic experience or even demand to, I mean, who's perfect, right? But where does that come from? Why do we think we have to be perfect?
I think there are multiple places. I do think that comparisons can be really difficult in this area. And certainly social media, that has just exploded. But we tend to, in the research I found, we tend to use comparison more often when we're feeling insecure mm-hmm. or negative or being critical of ourselves. So that is just the perfect storm, right? We're feeling badly about ourselves. And who do we choose to necessarily compare ourselves to? Do I think of someone who's also struggling and living a life and just trying to do her best in these different roles? Or do I think of some idealized version I've seen on TV or in social media, which is just one lens? It's one projection of success or beauty or the perfect body or what have you. So I think comparisons are really difficult and really catching when they're happening and who we choose to compare ourselves to. But I think there's also this sense with perfection that if we are striving for it or if we could potentially reach it, it would give us some control over our lives, control over our choices. But it's this illusion of control, unfortunately.
I mean, control can also mean controlling other people's reactions to us or to what we've said or done, which, mm-hmm. I mean, people are largely uncontrollable, aren't they?
They absolutely are. And I think we can get into a really tough situation where we're trying to control or preemptively saying, oh, I feel so guilty about that already. So you don't have to make me feel any worse about it, right? We're trying to kind of control that dynamic. But you're right, they're out of our sort of circle of control.
But is it this sort of a kind of a grandiosity, thinking we can control our little universe or our little universe within the larger universe?
Perhaps it is, but I do think it's a way of us coping with the uncertainty that we have in our lives, that if I can control everything, I can prevent bad things from happening, especially to the people I care most about. So whether you'd call it grandiosity or whether you'd call it just this attempt to wrest back control mm-hmm. in a time that understandably feels pretty chaotic right now.
We've been talking about guilt, but I have to say, reading through your book and even talking with you and putting my questions and things together, it sounds a lot like shame. And I think of, I mean, we could do a whole hour, what's guilt, what's shame, but I do think of shame as part of someone's identity. It's who I am. And the way you describe about how guilt really has sort of infected itself into these women's lives, it feels like it has become a part of their identity. Why is it guilt and not shame? Or maybe it is both.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it comes up a lot. What is the difference? And I tried to sort of, my big definition of the two is that guilt is really I've done something wrong.
Yes.
Or I've not done something I should. And shame is I am wrong, everything about me. And you're absolutely right. I think the guilt is growing to this, proportion that it's actually creating some feelings of shame. But what I find with this excessive guilt is that what it does is when we use guilt as our decision making, when guilt's in the driver's seat, we start doing more and more and more. We start taking on more responsibility. We absorb more responsibility. We keep the whole family calendar in our brains. We agree to do something at work that we really don't have time for. And it's sort of like we take action. When it comes to shame, there's some interesting suggestions in the data that it's like fight or flight. That when we feel shame, we actually do the opposite. We remove ourselves. We withdraw. And so in seeing women just take on and become sort of hyper-competent with this response to guilt, that's where I feel like that's taking us. Whereas when it does shift over to shame, there can be a real breakdown.
I mean, it feels like with shame, there's nothing good about shame, right? Whereas guilt can be reparative, as you mentioned earlier. I mean, if we've done something wrong, we've hurt someone or harmed someone, we can repair that. Mm-hmm. But shame is just, I mean, it just floods your body, it seems.
It is a really a negative emotion. I mean, I wouldn't want someone to be entirely shameless. I mean, when we think about speaking in hyperbole, there's some interesting data that certain cultures that are more kind of communal cultures actually see shame as sort of a more positive thing, demonstrating again that I'm part of this community and I see my role, whereas we in more individualistic cultures don't. But I do see shame, as I compare it to kind of the black mold that sort of grows and thrives in darkness, because it really can be such a difficult feeling that people have when they come into my practice.
You mentioned shoulds, and I remember being in college taking psychology classes and learning about this phrase. I think it was coined by psychoanalyst Karen Horney, the tyranny of the shoulds. And that's always stayed with me because I felt like it just encapsulates in a couple of words the tyranny of the shoulds, why shoulds are so tyrannical.
I think that's a great, great quote. And I think that that is where we can spot those expectations. If we're saying I should, really examining, well, who's defining what should be the case? Right. And where are we getting that answer? Is it society? Is it our family? Is it our work culture? Is it all of those things? And if so, am I going to continue to allow those expectations to drive my decision making? Yeah. Because they may not be ones that actually we even want. It may be an example you had from childhood that you very much do not want to emulate, right?
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's a psychiatrist, Jennifer Reed, joining us today on The Connection. And again, she's got a brand new book. It's called Guilt Free, and it's subtitled Reclaiming Your Life from Unreasonable Expectations. And we have been talking about some of those reasonable expectations. You mentioned hyper accountability. I mean, feeling just responsible for everything, which of course is impossible. What is driving that? And maybe it's all the things that we have been talking about, but to feel accountable, things that are really out of your control.
Well, I think if you think about how we used to exist in these small communities or these small tribes, and we're now in this place where we can just see everything that's happening globally. And so I think we have this awareness, this vision of sort of this global family, if you will, where we can see all these negative things happening to other people. And we have a strong sense of empathy. Many women, you know, there's some data that women even more intensely feel the experience of empathy. And so you see all of this that's happening. You feel, you empathize with these individuals and you think, I have to do something about this. And so our idea of responsibility, the circle has expanded exponentially, but our ability to control is still the same as it's always been. So that, I think, is where that disconnect is where people are really struggling, you know, with I should be doing more in all of these situations. Where do I even start?
Well, and I think that really describes how many people are feeling these days of looking around our country or the world and just seeing so much misery and feeling responsible, but also not knowing exactly what to do to fix it.
Yeah, and I think that's where I see people really talking about seeking community and seeking it locally. And I think that, again, that goes back to us evolutionarily, that we were used to being in this small group and that we could work together and that we could understand each other and see each other as a full person, which is very different than sort of the shadow person we can see, you know, on social media or in other areas like that.
I'm curious, too, and I got the feeling from reading the book that for women who are feeling this excessive, unreasonable expectation and feeling guilty about it, the criticism can be so wounding. I mean, it feels like, they caught me. I got caught somehow. Help us understand why that feels so painful.
Well, I think when you are just bending over backwards, trying to do everything perfectly, and someone says to you, you know what you just did, even in this very specific situation, hurt me, or that was upsetting, or that wasn't what we needed, we can broaden that. We can have something called cognitive distortions, where we sort of take that one instance and we broadly generalize it. We sort of catastrophize. This means that they think I'm doing a terrible job at work and I'm going to lose my job, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think we can take those sort of maybe very constructive criticisms sometimes and blow them up and expand them because we're saying, oh my gosh, this must mean something much bigger than this particular instance.
I mean, it sounds like it's a very self-conscious experience or emotion, that it's focusing on the self because you feel so wounded or exposed.
Right. And how do I cope with this internally? And I think if the coping is, I feel really guilty, the guilt is telling me I need to do more. You know what? Maybe I've said something that's disappointed someone I care about. I feel really guilty, and therefore I'm trying to immediately make up for it. maybe by deciding to do things that actually aren't what I want to be doing or can do. And so I think it's just recognizing that when guilt's in the driver's seat that way, we're going to make decisions that don't align with what is actually best for us, as opposed to using something like self-compassion, which I wrote about a lot in the book because I found it so helpful, and I do find it so helpful even in my daily life. How do we look at ourselves with curiosity and compassion? It doesn't mean we only say, I only pay attention to what I've done well, but that we can look at it in a really balanced way and be kind to ourselves, even when we've messed up. Because guess what? We do.
We do, indeed. But it also seems like being a detective. I mean, if the focus has been on perfection and control and a kind of hyper experience of trying to manage the world, that it can be difficult to look inside because everything is out there. So you have to spend some time to be a detective. Like, why do I feel this way? Why does my body react the way it does?
Right. And if you're a detective and you're afraid that what you're going to find is that I am inherently flawed in some deep way, it can be really scary to investigate. And one of the reasons I wanted to write about this emotion is that I wanted women to realize that it's not because they individually are getting something wrong, or like everyone else is doing enough and I'm not, or everyone else is more successful, et cetera, than me. I think it's recognizing that this is a world that we're living in. This is not our inside our fault, but we do have the capacity to change the way that we're approaching those thoughts and feelings and sort of rewrite some of those distorted thoughts to be more fair to us and really allow us to take a step forward with agency rather than guilt.
It's hard to do, though, isn't it? I mean, haven't you found, even if you feel anxious and you don't want to feel the way you do, it's hard to change. It's not impossible, but it's hard.
It is really hard. I mean, I still have these guilty thoughts that come up all the time. Like an example, I was out of town earlier this week. I usually help my kids get up in the morning, get breakfast, give them a ride to school. We had a friend that drove them, but it was sort of chaos. One forgot his winter coat. You know how cold it is right now. He forgot his charger, forgot to pack anything to eat, even though there wasn't any lunch at school because of midterms, just all these different things. And I thought, oh, wow, I should have done something better to prepare them. I should have had all of that laid out. But then I also had the guilty thought of like, maybe I'm not teaching them enough independence that they can't handle one morning without me. These thoughts don't disappear. I still have them. But I say to myself, let me think about the expectations here. A, is expectation I'm never away in the morning? Does that seem fair or reasonable? Yeah. Is the expectation that I can actually somehow teach them independence entirely? Not necessarily. I can do my best, but I think it still comes up a lot for me as well.
I mean, it's so interesting because you're steeped in this, and yet, of course, there it was, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think you can escape it, and I don't think I want people to say, I'm never going to feel this way. You know, it comes up in with anxiety in my practice. I just want the anxiety to be gone. But anxiety is part of being human. It's right. Part of our reaction, a signal from things around us, similar disappointment, guilt. These are all signals. But the question is, what do we do when we experience them?
You write an interesting thing that guilt can distract us from deeper, maybe even more complicated feelings, such as?
Well, I was talking about the book, and one of the people that was listening mentioned sort of familial estrangement and the guilt that she was feeling in setting boundaries on a relationship that really has not been healthy for her. And we explored how actually that guilt might be a way to protect her from grief in that situation of, I've either lost someone I was formerly close to, or I've lost the ability to have someone in that role. Maybe it was a father or a mother or other sibling. I've lost the opportunity to have someone in that role that really helped take care of me and loved me and supported me. And so grief is one of those, I think, that guilt can sort of push aside commonly, but it can happen with any number of emotions.
Yeah. I mean, thinking of anger, disappointment. I mean, it's probably a long list of things. And so that under those circumstances, feeling guilty is sort of beating ourselves up because we can't deal with some of this deeper stuff.
Well, I think, it's not allowing us to process those emotions, so that's at high cost. But I think it does feel, in a sense, protective because it's the same story. We're used to this story. Oh, I've done something wrong. This estrangement has happened because I messed something up. Or I'm feeling angry because I didn't communicate what I wanted better. So I think it's a familiar story that we can kind of go to, and it doesn't force us to get into some of these other emotions that are difficult to face and we don't feel like we have much control over. you know, which with guilt at least gives us that illusion, right?
You write, guilt protects us from the vulnerability of feeling too happy. And I underscored that because how does happiness make us feel vulnerable and guilty?
Well, I remember when my first son was born and he was a really good baby. And I was like, this is great. But I felt guilty because I was like, maybe I shouldn't feel this way because somehow that could lead to harm. Something bad could happen if I don't. It's like this magical thinking, you know? Or if we find that, and we'll do this, we'll apologize to others like this in a group of women. We'll say, well, thank you so much for my promotion. You're right. It's very exciting. But I haven't been exercising enough,
right,
or I haven't been around my family enough. It's almost a sense that we don't want others to perceive us as sort of too happy because they knock us down a notch, perhaps, or that if we feel too happy, that puts us in a vulnerable position for loss of that happiness.
And maybe we don't trust happiness, right? That it's another illusion.
Right, and that it could be something that would slip away. I mean, the challenge is you can't always be happy. Happiness is another of those emotions that's temporary, but that it's not something that's putting us at higher risk, you know, to allow that connection. But love brings vulnerability because we love this being, this person, these people who aren't going to live forever, for example, or who may depart from our life earlier than that. And that's really scary for a lot of us.
Yeah, almost up on our second break here, but just interesting that we talk so much about sort of striving for happiness, and there's a lot of psychology related to happiness, and I hadn't really put guilt and happiness together.
Yeah, I do think this sense that I should be happy is yet another reason. You know, I should be more grateful that everything's going well. Why am I feeling sad today? Or why am I feeling frustrated or scared or any of these feelings? I should be feeling happy. Mm-hmm. So there's also that pressure we put on ourselves that if we're not happy, it's something we've done wrong. Right.
There's the tyranny of the shoulds again,
absolutely,
raising their ugly head. Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Jennifer Reed. She's a psychiatrist here in the Philadelphia area. She's also an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and we have been talking about her new book. It's titled Guilt Free, and it's subtitled Reclaiming Your Life from Unreasonable Expectations, written in part from her experiences working with a lot of her female patients. We have much more to talk about after this very short break, including how to become more guilt-free. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about guilt, which can be a helpful emotion for repairing relationships. It can also make us feel worthless and inadequate. And again, our guest is psychiatrist Jennifer Reed, talking about how to manage excessive guilt. And her new book is titled Guilt Free, Reclaiming Your Life from Unreasonable Expectations. And she writes about the four apocalypse of guilt. And I'll just tick them off here, which we have touched on: constant caretaking, perfectionism, hyper-accountability, and trying to have it all, be all things to all people. Well, let's talk about how we sort of address some of these really toxic emotions that we have related to this level of guilt. How do we get to know ourselves better?
Well, I think having a name for what this feeling is, the sense of never doing enough, is really important. Because if you don't have a name for something, you know, you can't sort of push back against a shadow. You need to be able to describe it. And the reason I found the guilt equation, and find it helpful even in my own life, is that I can think about each of those two variables.
Right.
My expectations, and then how I'm perceiving reality. And there really is a lot of room on both, and for both of those variables, to make a shift. How do I, again, question where those expectations came from, whether or not I want to keep them, and should they stay or should they go, essentially. And then on the other side, how can I adjust how I'm perceiving my reality if I'm really not being fair to myself?
Is that sort of the critical question? Am I not being fair to myself?
Am I not being fair to myself? Am I not giving myself credit for all the ways that I am showing up, that I'm taking care of myself, that I'm present in this moment and caring for others, certainly, but not trying to make that so perfect and dismissing anything that falls short of that impossible expectation.
I mean, that sounds so rational. I know people can be rational, but to be able to sort of inventory this and that, I think that's hard, right?
It is hard. I think we have this natural bias, this negativity bias, to focus on what we'd like to do differently or improve. That's where there are some different strategies I include in the book, because those are the ones I found most helpful in my practice and in my life. One being what's called a three blessings exercise or three good things exercise from positive psychology, Martin Seligman's work at Penn and others, is at the end of the day, pulling out a notebook and writing down three things that went well that day. And why they happened. And I actually do this around the dinner table with my family some nights and just say, okay, everyone needs to tell me three things that went well today. And they can be really, really tiny things. They don't have to be some huge change. But my son might say, you know, I helped another friend with a math problem today. Or a teacher told me I was being really polite in the lunch line. Just small things. And again, it just helps us to shift and focus our attention on the things that we've done well that day, because otherwise we don't even remember so many of them.
And I would think with excessive guilt, you can feel like an inauthentic person, right? You're so busy taking care of other people that you don't really put your full self forward. People might not know you because you haven't really been honest, if I can put it that way, about how you're really feeling about something.
Right. You maybe haven't been able to say, this is what I would want and need, because your sense is, I need to take care of everyone first, but then there's no next step, right? We run out of time before we get to ourselves. So that women might say to me, you know, I had some time to myself today, and I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't even know what's fun for me, what brings me joy. And I think when they start to really recognize that, there's a sense of grief, like, why is it like this? How have I come to this place? And we have to allow ourselves to feel that, that maybe we have been working so hard to try and take care of everyone else that we sort of lost ourselves. But that's temporary. Here we are. We're with ourselves every single day, all day. How can we start to pay a bit more attention to the positive things we're doing and the good things about ourselves? So our inner monologue is not just, this is wrong, you should do this better.
And we all have that inner monologue. I mean, I know my inner monologue quite well, and I often have to fight with it, but we're always talking to ourselves, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Narrating our lives, narrating what's going on around us.
We are, and that's where it's important when we do like cognitive behavioral therapy, recognizing that we are not our thoughts, right? We're some other entity, which when you get into it, the philosophy there is really fascinating, but that we can recognize that's an anxious thought.
Right.
When I say, what if, that's probably leading into an anxious thought, and we can work on that. Think of that as a rough draft, and I'm going to rewrite that because that's actually not working in my life. It's not working for me. And then doing that over and over again, because that's what really helps us change those patterns in our brain.
By changing the words we're using, the words we're saying to ourselves.
Absolutely. Those words are so powerful, but they don't define us. They are just ones that we've been telling ourselves maybe for years. We don't have to continue that narrative.
You know, picking up on that, we were talking about this before going on the air, and you were saying one of the reasons you like being a psychiatrist is you're interested in stories, in storytelling. And of course, I would assume with therapy is all about storytelling. But sometimes we have this narrative that we've lived, and it's so hard to give that up because that's who we are. Even if it isn't working for us, it defines us. It has been our life until it doesn't seem to work anymore.
Yeah, and I think the word ambivalence is really important to talk about with individuals. This comes up a lot, for example, in women who've had a new baby, and their expectation is that they are going to feel constant joy and connection and love and all of the good things. And yes, those emotions will probably be there, but so many others, like boredom, sadness, fear, exhaustion.
Yeah.
And so I think the idea of ambivalence is really important. And even making this change to lower our guilt, we might feel ambivalence about the changes that happen, which is, okay, I've started setting limits on everyone coming to me when they need something, but I miss feeling like I'm the one everyone comes to when they need something. So recognizing that there will be some pieces of making this change that might be difficult or we might miss, but why are we doing it? Right. What is it going to actually give us back?
Because there are benefits to being the heroine, as you write, right?
Yes.
The problem solver, the person that people come to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's hard to say. I mean, we're not going to say we're not that at all anymore. I think that's what's important. This all or nothing thinking gets us into trouble. That still very much may be our persona, but we're saying, and I talk to healthcare providers about this, what can I provide? I'm doing really important work, but if I'm doing it when I'm exhausted and depleted, I'm not able, that's not sustainable. It's not safe.
You mentioned earlier about, I mean, that we live in family systems, and when someone changes, the system often fights back or resists that kind of change. And I'm trying to imagine a mom, let's say, in a family saying, well, you know, I'm not going to be the person that get the kids up in the morning. I'm going to let them figure this out for themselves. And there can be such resistance to that because you're changing the rules.
Right. And that there can be resistance in a way that really makes us feel awful because it's really designed to evoke guilt. I mean, the idea of manipulative guilt is really interesting in that it seems to be groups with lesser power or a person with lesser power trying to get someone with more power to do what they want.
Right.
So your kids, for example, may say, well, but mom, that means that we're just going to be so unhappy and we're going to be so hungry and cold, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a guilt trip, right?
Right, a guilt trip. And so it's recognizing, again, what am I going to get from creating more space and time in my own life?
And is that the goal? I mean, for people that are really dogged by this perfectionism, that I need more time for me?
Well, just that I can look at myself in a more fair way and know that I am a human, so I'm going to have emotions. I'm going to have physical and emotional needs. I'm going to need rest. I'm going to need time, you know, healthy food, maybe time for exercise, all of those things that instead of putting myself dead last because guilt's telling me I need to take care of everyone first, what's a more balanced way to approach it? This doesn't mean I'm going to just step out and not help my kids ever, but how can I do that in a balanced way and also encourage them to do that in their own lives, right? If I have daughters, I have boys, but if I had girls, how do I help them to set those limits? And how do I model for them that I can make choices that are actually best for me and that being a grown-up or being a parent is not just exhaustion and selflessness.
And self-sacrificing, yes.
Because who wants that, you know, exclusively?
Well, and it sounds like it. If someone is listening to this or thinking about, you know, I've had enough, I'm feeling just overwhelmed by the kind of guilt that I'm feeling, you have to tell people, right, what you're doing, that you want to make some changes in your own life.
Absolutely.
Rather than springing it on them, saying, all right, that's it. I'm not doing carpooling anymore.
Right. I've had several interesting questions where, you know, men have asked, how can I help or how can I be present? And I think one of the answers might be, take a look at some of those concepts in the book so that you can be another voice in your partner's life saying, of course, you don't have to do all of this by yourself. And I think that piece is important, too, is that those around you can be aware of it and even support you. And I think when you're with groups of women or connecting with other women, that you're also not policing each other for not having enough guilt. Because sometimes guilt can be a way of showing I care, right? But it can be used almost excessively in that way. The only way I can prove that I care enough is if I feel guilty if I'm not doing absolutely everything. And so I think when we talk about it with other women, supporting each other in our own quest to feel less guilty is going to be really important.
Do you think women do that too much? In a sense, putting guilt, maybe unintended, but putting guilt on other women for not doing enough?
Or just wondering, you know, why isn't she feeling guilty for doing something that seems like it's just for her?
Right.
And so I think when you feel that from other people or other women, you say, well, maybe this is wrong. But what if we're all doing it? What would it feel like to be part of a community that's saying, let's have a balanced perspective here, that I do recognize that I do have needs and desires, and that this is really important. And this, I could still feel like I'm part of this because other people are making this, are taking this path or making this exploration in their own lives.
You talk about something called a growth mindset. And I think, you know, we think of developing, growing up, becoming an adult, it doesn't end there. I mean, hopefully it doesn't end there, that we're constantly wanting to change and be a better version of ourselves. Help us understand what that growth mindset can be.
Growth mindset is so powerful because it really looks at we're never done growing, which we know about the human brain, that's really the truth, and that we can look at challenges, we can look at really having to work hard at something, as a positive thing, as opposed to that our intelligence, say, is static and we can only just go about to prove how smart we are. Instead, it's, you know what, I can actually grow in this way. I can tell myself that I have to work hard at something. That's really positive because I'm putting myself toward that. I mean, writing a book was certainly an example for me saying, this isn't going the way I want it to, or I've read all these wonderful books. Why am I not writing like that? And trying to push through that. And also see other people's successes not as a threat to me, but as inspiration to me. And I think that's really powerful, too, because when we're doing playing that comparison game, if we're able to say, oh, look, she did it. Maybe I could do it, too. I think that's a really positive aspect of growth mindset as well.
You talk about the kind of short-term, I guess, benefits or consequences of guilt, which is you get it done and then it's done and you can move on. But the long-term consequences are much more complicated and more destructive.
Absolutely. The idea that we can use guilt as a motivator, which is very, very common, that we tell ourselves all these bad things if we don't do something. Oh my gosh, if I don't call my sister on her birthday, I'm the worst person in the universe. Well, it's not ideal, but the trouble with motivating through guilt is that it forces us to start from behind. We've already messed something up. We've already missed out on something, and now we need to remedy it, as opposed to something like self-compassion, again, motivating us in some way. This is something I want to do. I want to call my sister because I love her, and I want to make sure she knows that. If I've messed up, maybe I'll try and do it, call her the next day, for example. So using guilt as a motivator is expensive because it's forcing us to kind of go to that place of, well, I've already messed up. Now I better make a different choice.
And I would think, too, that part of this is also learning to accept that you're going to disappoint people. If you've been the person who has taken care of everything and you decide, okay, I'll do this, but I'm not going to do that, people are going to be disappointed. How do we live with that level of disappointment?
Yeah, disappointment is such a difficult thing. I use the example of, you know, when a young child falls down and there are all these adults standing around, the way the adults respond to that determines how that child is going to respond to that, right? If the adults are all like, oh my goodness, are you okay? Are you hurt? Versus like, oh, good work, hop on up. And I think that can be the same thing with disappointment too. I think we're in this place where we feel like disappointment is dangerous or damaging and I need to remedy it right away. If my child's feeling disappointed, I need to make sure he's not feeling that right away. My parents are disappointed in me because I didn't come to dinner. I'll promise to come the next day, even if I can't really do that because work schedule, for example. So I think it's recognizing disappointment is a human experience. It is temporary, and it doesn't have to be immediately fixed because that's suggesting that it is something that's highly damaging. I want my kids to know that they can feel disappointed and they'll survive it. And I will know as a mother that I can see them being disappointed, and yet we're still going to have a loving connection. Because you can be a loving person and still disappoint people, because you always will, you know, at times have that situation.
I mean, that gets to the perfectionism part, which is you're not allowed to disappoint anybody because you have to be perfect.
Right. And that's impossible. If you have many roles, you always are in this situation where you have to let someone down, and you can't even control. You can't, you know, bend over backwards to try and prevent disappointment. It can still happen. That person is still allowed to have that feeling. And so trying to, you know, run around trying to avoid disappointment is really exhausting and creating a lot of guilt.
And I guess part of it is learning that when good enough is good enough, right? Whatever that means.
Right, that we can embrace being good enough. You know, the sort of Winnicott idea around a good enough mother. But I think in any role that, you know what, I want to show up in this role in this way. And if I don't get it the way I want it to, tomorrow is the next day. That growth mindset is I can grow and change. And sometimes we do something that we really regret. And the only way that we can move on is simply to say, I wish that hadn't happened. I'm going to learn from it and I'm going to move forward. And I think that really is maturity and that's growth. And that's what I see people do that really begin to get rid of guilt.
You talk about going from being liked or even being loved to being respected and trusted. Flesh that out for us.
Well, the example I give is that as a psychiatrist, there are many situations where I'm making a suggestion or a treatment plan that doesn't align with what they want because I know it's not the best fit for them. And so I think that if I'm always trying to be liked, I could be making choices that really are not professionally appropriate. And I think you can have that situation happen in any number of roles where in trying to be liked, you're taking on more, you're doing more, you're trying to be hyper accountable, all those things. And again, you can't be sure that someone else is right. going to like you.
We got to leave it there. Jennifer Reed, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Marty, thank you for having me. This was wonderful.
It was wonderful for us as well. And again, the book is titled Guilt-Free, Reclaiming Your Life from Unreasonable Expectations. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen on the WHYY app. You can follow The Connection on Instagram, and you can also find the show on Facebook. Also, check out our website, whyy.org/theconnection, for information about upcoming shows. Al Banks, the engineer, and Debbie Builder, the producer of the show.